Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Thursday, September 3rd. This morning, we look at a list of Hawaii's most profitable companies. At the top is Matson. The transportation services company has held the spot for the last 5 years. We also look at the cost of natural disasters, and now with federal funding cuts affecting NOAA, we also learn who's keeping track of what these days. It's Tech Week in Hawaii, with many events scheduled to raise awareness about what's possible as we move into the era of AI. We hear one local company's story about how it's using artificial intelligence. And our weekly series, Homeroom Hawaii, takes us across the state to see how schools are coping with the weather disturbances. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This morning, we highlight the effort by Hawaii Business Magazine to compile its list of top 250 companies. This month's edition looks at organizations which are the most profitable. Ken Wills is the managing editor of Hawaii Business Magazine. He breaks down the numbers and the rankings.
Every year, we rank the companies and organizations in Hawaii. We take a look at the top 250, and they self-report their earnings and their revenue and their employee numbers and a whole bunch of other data. And we make the list. And so we, from the 250, we look at who's the most profitable. So for the last 5 years in a row, Matson has come out on top as the most profitable company in the state. And it's very interesting why they have, last year, of course, they had buffeted by tariffs, global tariffs, which caused their overall revenues to drop 6.5%, but they still came out on top as the most profitable. They're our main supplier, shipping supplier to the islands, but they also operate a fleet that goes to Alaska, Guam, Southeast Asia, Japan, China, and the U.S. West Coast. So they make this big loop of ships going, bringing goods all around that region. Yeah, they have a unique niche in the market. They're not the biggest ocean shipper in the world, but they have a very specific niche that they cover, and they cover it very well, and they can, as a result, charge a premium to what other shippers do around the world. And they've been very successful at it. So that's how they topped the list this year.
Yeah, I mean, they have, you know, deep roots here in the islands. And, you know, I mean, you see those shipping containers everywhere. So I really love the cover stacked,
yeah.
You know, with the shipping a container graphic. I mean, it just, you know, it speaks volumes.
Our creative director has a very good imagination, and she can take stories and make them visually attractive as well. And so it was a very nice cover to illustrate this issue.
Yes, and it's green. Who's in the green and not in the red? And so talk about the other companies that folks might, you know, assume would be, you know, in the top 10. You know, we've got banks, and I mean, it's an interesting list.
Yeah, 12 of the top 20 were financial companies. First Hawaiian Bank is second. They had an astounding 20% jump in profit from the prior year. The profit's around $276 million. They had a very good year, and that led to one of their acquisitions. They announced this July they're planning to take over California-based Trico bank shares. And one of the rationale expressed for that purchase was that mainland growth rates are higher than here in Hawaii, and they wanted to tap into the mainland, sort of expanding beyond Hawaiian shores. Other top financial firms besides First Hawaiian Bank, Bank of Hawaii, number 3, American Savings Bank, number five, Central Pacific Financial, number six, and then an insurance company, First Insurance Company of Hawaii, number seven. So a lot of financial companies piling up at the top, mostly because of loan issuance and interest margin improvements. So that kind of led the financial sector.
And then what's notable, too, is Hawaiian Electric Industries, right? Because they took a hit with the wildfires and the settlement.
So our list is of the numbers from 2025. 2024, we all remember, Hawaiian Electric had the massive loss of $1.4 billion as part of this settlement to the Maui wildfires settlement. And they were able to turn it around to a profit of $123 million last year. So they are normally up in that end of the business, but they had a terrible year with the wildfire settlement. And then this year, or last year, and ongoing into this year, the two Kona low storms, the latest Hurricane Lala problems that affect their infrastructure. And so they're really being pummeled. They did have a good year last year. This current year is going to be a little bit questionable because of those storms. And now they have asked the Utilities Commission for two rate increases for the 2 years, 2027, 2028. Yeah, so that's an interesting company to watch for the year ahead.
Yeah, and as I was perusing the list, the other things that jumped out at me, HMSA, it was down at the bottom, and Hawaiian Telcom.
Yeah, so HMSA, which is the state's largest enterprise based on revenue, yes, in terms of profit, it's much lower, and that's interesting. So we also look later, we can talk about profit per employee and profit per revenue. But Hawaiian Telcom is now, because Hawaiian Electric is no longer in the red, Hawaiian Telcom was leading the bottom. And the reason there is that they, for the last 2 years, have been investing heavily in the state to install a fiber optics network.
Yes.
To make Hawaii, they're saying Hawaii will be the first state in the nation to be fully fiber optic. I think it's early 2027 now that they're targeting that will happen. But that's the result of a lot of investment during the last 2 years. So they had losses of around $60 million in each of the last 2 years. But they're hoping that once this is all in place, they're going to have more subscribers, they're going to have faster service, more reliable service, and that will pay off over time.
Yeah, the list is just fascinating. And like you said, though, you know, you may be wondering about some entities that you might think would be on this list, but it's a self-reporting thing, right?
Yes. So some private companies don't report their profits. Some parent companies don't break out Hawaii-specific profits. So those become an issue. A very large company, Alaska Airlines, Hawaiian Airlines, they don't break out specific Hawaii profit. So they're one of the largest companies by revenue, but we can't include them in this case. So that's okay. We have an awful lot of companies that do voluntarily report their revenues and profits. And so these figures are quite interesting.
Yes, it's a fascinating list and fascinating reading. But thank you so much, Ken.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
That was Ken Wills, Hawaii Business Magazine's managing editor. And a note to our listeners, Matson and HMSA are financial supporters of Hawaii Public Radio.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Olson Trust, envisioning a Hawaii where its people are supported by the land, and the land is taken care of by its people. OlsonTrust.com.
Relations between the Trump administration and Canada are increasingly fraught. Take this zinger from Ontario Premier Doug Ford.
I don't respond to a dictator like President Trump. a bully like President Trump?
Much of Canada shares that sentiment, but officials in Ottawa still need to maintain a working relationship with their biggest ally. That's next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. In Divine Disruption, The Art of Tseren Chirpa, the Nepalese artist explores issues such as migration and identity. Now on view, honolulumuseum.org.
For 45 years, NOAA logged every U.S. climate and weather disaster that cost at least $1 billion into a single database. It included more than 400 major events, totaling more than $3 trillion in damages. When the Trump administration cut funding for the project last summer, it looked like that effort may come to an end. But within a year, the nonprofit organization Climate Central revived the database with the help of NOAA climate scientist Adam Smith. Smith oversaw the database for 15 years at NOAA and then decided to leave the federal agency to continue that work at Climate Central. He told HBR's Savannah Herman-Pote that he felt the database was simply too important to stop being updated, and why that billion-dollar threshold matters when thinking about disasters.
So even though $1 billion is an arbitrary threshold, these most costly events account actually for the majority of the damage that's recorded from U.S. weather and climate extremes. More than 80% of the damage comes from these billion-dollar disasters.
Okay, and since the database has been logging these climate and weather disasters since 1980, are these events becoming more frequent or more costly over that time period?
Yes, the average number of billion-dollar disasters per year has actually grown from about 3 events in the 1980s to around 20 events over the last 10 years. The cost of these billion-dollar disasters has also surged, with 4 of the top 5 most costly years on record over this last decade as well. There are a number of factors for why that is the case. We have more exposure, more value in harm's way, more vulnerability, including where we build and how we build. Examples would be like the wildland-urban interface with wildfire impacts, or the coast or river basins with flood impacts and hurricane impacts. But of course, these trends are further complicated by lack of building codes in places. We know that those could reduce damages. But the 800-pound gorilla in the room would be certainly climate change, which is supercharging both the frequency and intensity of some types of these extremes into billion-dollar disasters. So examples would be the rise in vulnerability to drought and lengthening wildfire seasons in the U.S. West, potential for heavy rainfall and intensifying hurricanes when conditions are available for that development in the East. So either way you look at it, the rise in disaster costs is a human-made problem.
I want to bring in another factor that affects climate and affects our vulnerability to climate and weather disasters, and that's El Nino. We're in the middle of an El Nino event now, and scientists are anticipating that this could be one of the strongest El Nino events on record. Does the database show an increase in major climate and weather events during past El Nino events?
So we've not yet studied that connection closely, but there are several interrelated factors that contribute to creating a billion-dollar disaster event. Certainly, El Nino has strong regional effects, including increasing rainfall potential and hurricane potential, as we see here in the Pacific, as Hawaii itself has had several hurricanes come near it, more so than in recent years. And of course, over the summer, there were a record number of heat waves in the United States and in Europe, and destructive wildfires in places like Colorado, Washington, Oregon, and of course, other even countries, because El Nino has affected the whole globe. So Canada, Spain, France, a lot of places have had heat and fire that are related to kind of the ENSO cycle, amplifying baseline weather. So El Nino is kind of tricky to isolate on itself, because climate change is, you know, over time amplifying a lot of these trends in a much more profound way, whereas the ENSO cycle, the El Nino part of ENSO, is on top of that baseline of increased climate change impacts that we're seeing.
Hawaii has three entries in the database: Hurricane Aniki, which hit Kauai in the 90s, the Maui fires in 2023, and the most recent entry is the Konolau storms that occurred across the islands in March. The state is also currently calculating the cost of Hurricane Lala, which did serious damage to infrastructure and homes. And I'm curious, because we had these two big weather events in one year, how common is it for a state to experience more than $1 billion disaster in a single year?
Only a few states per year typically experience multiple events with at least $1 billion in damage per event. States like Texas and Florida are often impacted by hurricanes, flooding, and severe storms, while states like California can experience more than $1 billion wildfire in a year. At least we've seen that in the last decade. Many of the billion-dollar disaster events are multi-state events where states have damages more in the hundreds of millions of dollars each per event that kind of add up. So indeed, it is a bit rare to have multiple billion-dollar events within a single state in one year.
Do you think that's something that, based on the trends you're observing in the database, may become more common?
Yes, I think it will be more common to see more states have multiple billion-dollar events. One thing I actually didn't mention, I think is really important, this concept of compound disasters with cascading impacts. One great example is in the U.S. western states, they had a snow drought, which was bad for tourism and the local economy across many states last winter. That snow drought turned into a hydrologic drought, lack of rain, lack of snowpack, which then increased the wildfire potential and made the wildfire season happen sooner. It's going to happen longer. There's more impactful, destructive wildfires, in that region, but also, east of these wildfires in the west, the smoke, that's really bad news for people who have respiratory issues. And that's the type of cost that's not captured. So the compound disasters with the cascading impacts is just a fancy way of saying we're getting more disasters in a tighter space-time window. So what that does is it lengthens recovery time, makes it more complex and more costly. And that's the type of trend we're seeing in more places as we move into the future.
When a community is in recovery from a previous disaster, are they more vulnerable to enduring higher costs of a follow-up disaster?
Yeah, I think what it is, it's chaos on top of more chaos, because built systems, human systems, financial systems, to all try to work in tandem to create a recovery process. That's happening, and then something else comes, and it's maybe isn't even the same hazard, maybe it's a different type of hazard, and it just kind of like throwing a rock in the pond. It creates another set of ripples, which everyone has to deal with. So it's the fact that we're seeing more of those. In fact, back in the 1980s, the United States would go roughly 3 months between billion-dollar disasters. In the last decade, it's closer to every 3 weeks, 2 or 3 weeks between a billion-dollar disaster. So the shorter time interval is a new challenge that certain parts of the country for certain hazard combinations are having to deal with more of. So therefore, we have to be even more proactive and understand what are the best practices to get a community, to get a family, to get a business, to get society back to where it was before the disaster.
And may I ask, have you had any personal experience with any of these significant billion-dollar disasters?
Unfortunately, I have had several. Hurricane Helene, which happened in 2024, is located in Asheville, North Carolina, and even a tropical storm, Fred, which unfortunately several people lost their lives, 30 or 40 minutes from my house, the flood from a storm that was, had come off the ocean 400 miles away. So it's to study these events, but then to live through the events are completely different. And I think we have to learn from these events, because they will continue to happen, these extreme events, and will surprise us in different ways. So preparing before, during, and after an event takes place, and learning previous lessons from previous disasters in terms of mitigation and adaptation are really key for society.
Mm. I can see how that personal experience would underscore the importance of the work that you do. Did it also give you a different perspective on what can and can't be calculated when a community endures one of these major disasters?
Yeah, I think that one thing that's challenging is the more profound a disaster is, and Helene was certainly a profound disaster for many states from Florida through the Carolinas, it takes years, sometimes even up to a decade, to fully recover, if that's even possible, from a disaster. And things change, things are never the same sometimes, but often you want to try to enhance your built environment, your social environment, to be more resilient, more prepared for the next disaster, because unfortunately, as the data shows, these extremes are just going to continue. So trying to stay ahead of this trend is really the key.
And that was climate scientist Adam Smith with Climate Central talking about the work of the U.S. billion-dollar weather and climate disaster database. The March Kona lows marked Hawaii's third entry into the database. As for Hurricane Lala, the costs are still being calculated. The Hawaii Emergency Management Agency told HPR that as of August 31st, it had assessed more than $83 million in damage to public infrastructure. It's also assessed damage for nearly 200 homes so far. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's quiz, we consider the coconut. We consider its tree. We use each part of the coconut. That's all we need. It's a staple across many oceanic cultures because of its usefulness. The water provides hydration. The meat provides food. The oil is helpful in cooking and craft making. And the husk provides tough fibers for rope and mats. One island nation in Micronesia is famous for making full-body armor out of woven coconut fiber. Creating the armor was a community effort that took months. Green coconut husks had to be soaked in tidal mud, beaten, dried, and hand-rolled into a cord called a teora. Teora is elastic, it's thick, and it has a similar protective strength to fiberglass. These cords were layered into suits of armor, which were then decorated with geometric patterns woven with human hair. In the island's nation culture, human hair carried spiritual power and added an extra layer of ancestral protection. For today's quiz, we want to know what island nation used the coconut to create full-body armor. Call 808-941-3689 or toll free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right scores an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for families of agricultural workers and retirees, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation. NereidHawaii.com.
HPR is your source for music with culture. Every Sunday, we give you the recipe for a flavorful afternoon and evening. Start off with Kanikapila Sunday at 2 p.m.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Kanikapila Sunday from Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Keali'i Loma.
Mix in some Hawaii Kula'iwi at 6.
Aloha mai kako ke ho'olohenei oko ya Hawaii Kula'iwi ma Hawaii Public Radio 1. Ovono keio DJ Mermaid.
Then add a little spice from the Brazilian Experience at 7.
Olá, minha gente. Bem-vindos à Brazilian Experience. Sou eu, Sandy Tsukiyama, com vocês. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Brazilian Experience.
HPR is your favorite hotspot, serving up the music that feeds your day. Let's keep moving forward together. Donate at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Consider the coconut.
The what?
Consider its trees. each part of the coconut. That's all we need.
We make our nets from
we
the
make
fibers.
Our nets from the water is
sweet inside.
Water is sweet
we
inside.
Use the leaves to build
we use
fires.
The leaves to build
we cook
fires.
Up the meat
we cook
inside.
Up the meat inside.
Consider the coconuts.
The
trunks and the leaves.
The island gives us what we need.
An AI basics workshop was put on for small businesses late last month by the Chamber of Commerce Hawaii. Evan Patek, who owns co-owns leadership development firm Tailored Leadership Solutions, attended that event. He sat down with HBR's Kevin Allen. He says for many entrepreneurs, it's a mixed bag of trying to stay human while using the tools available to stay alive.
We have built out a curriculum, and we certainly did use AI to help consolidate and research. So, you know, if we have this large curriculum that we have to teach over a long period of time, you know, what are the through lines? What are the things that we want to make sure that are consistent, that are scientifically backed, right? They're not just, oh, I saw this YouTube short, so it's probably real. So we've used it lightly, but certainly I think it's not something that we rely on, but it's really helped us gather information, I think, more quickly and has allowed us to do research more intently.
And so now after this workshop, did you feel, I guess, differently about AI? Did it change your perception of all of how you'd want to use it or possibly implement it?
Yeah, so there's certainly some things that he had talked about, the gentleman who ran it, that we hadn't thought about. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's always good information there. And I think the other thing that I really took away from it that made me feel good was that you never know if you're really using AI properly. And so, you know, you can find other information online. Should I use this? How do I prompt? But there is something about getting a human to tell you, hey, here's what I've experienced and I've studied it and this is a good way to do it. And so I think there's something about getting that closed feedback loop from a human that even if you're already kind of using it, you're like, oh, okay, good. There's a professional in front of me, not just someone trying to commoditize my attention or someone trying to sell me something. And so for me, a lot of it was just reinforcement that we can use it. It's good. Here are the different ways to. If you're already doing it this way, great. If you want to do better prompting or get better information, consider this. And then there were a few things he had talked about. For example, you can use AI to snip long form videos into shorter bite-sized ones. And we never really thought about that as far as if we want to do short clips, just talk for an hour and then have AI chop it up into 1 minute segments versus we were thinking, oh gosh, we have to sit here and record 100 of these small things and figure out what to do. So yeah, definitely really useful. And I felt good coming out of it.
Yeah. It can take a lot of the work out of busy work, mm-hmm. which is fantastic.
Yeah.
Always. And I do love the fact that, you know, despite it being an AI workshop, you needed a real person there
100%.
To give you that perspective. I mean, can you point to any other specific things that you got from the workshop that you're like, oh, this was a real aha moment or a light bulb moment that kind of changed your perception of using AI?
You know, like I said, we've been using it lightly and we've been following up, but there was a specific part where I do recall he kind of mapped out various ways that businesses can use it. And again, none of them I think were earth shattering, but just a good reminder of where you can find value in what it is you do. And also a reminder that there's so many varied levels of expertise that even if you are like us, just very novice at it, there's still a lot of value that can be taken from it. So I think for me, that was also one of the takeaways was just regardless of your level of expertise, you can use it and you can gain value at a very, very low barrier to entry. And you don't have to get all the way to an expert or coding or any of that. And you can still find a lot of value out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, you're in this workshop with a lot of your peers, a lot of other colleagues, small businesses, entrepreneurs. Was there anything eye-opening kind of seeing maybe how fellow small businesses, your fellow entrepreneurs were kind of using AI in similar small businesses, right? Similar manpower, similar problems you guys maybe are facing.
Yeah, it was interesting. There were a number of different businesses and you know, you do a little bit of socializing around it, mm-hmm. and it's fun to see how the different problems present for each company and how they're thinking about how do you solutionize that using AI. But a lot of people are automating things like billing, or there were talks about marketing campaigns. How do we reach out to these people? But we still want to feel human. We don't want it to be this cold message that goes out. And so there's a lot of just fine tuning, I think, that has to be done. But it's interesting to watch every industry trying to figure out how do they utilize it. I think the common thing that I got from a lot of the people there was AI is coming. We want to be cautious, but we also want to use it. So how do we use it, right? And we don't know what we don't know. So what's the best way for people who are running fitness centers and property management and leadership development who don't have the time and energy to learn how does AI really work. I think it's a really fun way to see these people trying to figure out where does this fit and get educated in a way that benefits their business.
You just briefly mentioned it, but I think it's something that is so important to small businesses and what makes them, you know, something that is so appealing in the backbone of America is that they are human, right? Like, I feel like when people support a small business, they can see the people that they're supporting. They can talk to those people. It's not this big faceless entity. It's not a Walmart. It's not a Target where, you know, you throw your money at it and then whoop, it's gone into the void of Target. Or, you know, when I support a small business, I really do feel like I am supporting people, a lot of times local people, right? And that is something that's really important to me as a consumer. You know, with the use of AI, how do you view the landscape of using AI and keeping the humanity of being a small business while implementing a tool that is literally not human, you know, an artificial intelligence?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. You know, I think there's two ways to answer that. I think in the broadest sense, most entrepreneurs, at least here in Hawaii, at least the small businesses, I think they want to do right by the community. And so a lot of them, I think, recognize that AI is a tool that is there hopefully to help them promote and send their message out, whatever that is. I don't get a sense that a lot of them are using it for, like you had mentioned, Walmart. They're not using it to like optimize price to the minute. They're using it to really figure out what are the things that I can do to save me time or money that allow me to do whatever my mission is here. And I think that's a really cool story. And I think as long as the entrepreneurs and the small business owners don't forget what they're trying to do, the tool will help accelerate whatever their mission is. And I think that's great. I think in the more narrow sense, certainly things like the work I do, which is leadership development, and there's tons of other industries, I don't want to just say mine, but there's always going to be a human element. You know, there's just, you cannot remove the human piece of it. At least we're not prepared for it at this point. It may be 20, 30, 50, maybe no amount of years until we're ready. But, you know, the coaching we do, you couldn't use a computer. I think people would reel against that. And even one of the things in the class that the gentleman leading it said, it cannot simulate empathy, right? I mean, it can give you the words and it can kind of explain to you, but humans are pretty keen to, this is not a human. And then we just naturally feel a sense of discomfort if we're trying to interact with it as if it were. I think there's a lot to be gained, but as long as people are social creatures, I think there's always going to be a void that AI just cannot fill.
Definitely. I hope so. It scares
Agreed.
Me.
Agreed.
You know, and that's, you know, that's another one of my anxieties about AI is that, you know, you'd mentioned like, yeah, AI can, it can send out these marketing campaigns, but at the same time, is that then some marketing freelance marketer's job, you know, using AI could also possibly mean that you're not using a freelancer, you're not using a video editor, you're not using a marketer.
Yeah, I think it's something that a lot of small businesses are mindful of. Again, when we have to use things, we always try to use outsource to local folks here, whether it's for our webpage, whether it's for photography, whether it's for whatever it is. But I think like every other business, there has to be a balance, right? You have to manage your costs in a way that's effective. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say you shouldn't use things. You know, if you can, I would always recommend find local, support the small businesses here. But I think there is going to be a balance to be struck as far as small things that just don't need to be done, right? Like if you're a small, again, like our company, two people, I don't need a whole marketing campaign, right? We don't have the budget for that. So maybe we will have to default to the AI and, you know, whatever that looks like. And
right.
I think a lot of companies are in that boat too, where it's like, do they really need a whole accounting team? Like, well, no, not really. So I think it's up to their discretion, but I think the vast majority, again, going back to my earlier sentiment, I think a lot of small businesses want to do right by the community, and you got to stay in business to keep supporting the community. So
totally.
Yeah.
And it's making the option available at the end of the day, right? Like it's, yeah, small businesses often are working on a very limited budget.
Yeah.
So it's like the option of having this option at all or like not really. I mean, not being able to afford it possibly.
Yeah, for sure. Having an AI marketing campaign for me is better than no marketing campaign.
Right.
So I guess it's in my benefit.
And, you know, as someone who plays in the field of leadership development and tailoring, you know, training content to meet the needs of specific businesses, is AI something that you guys now kind of have to think about in terms of like training people and with AI? Is that something that is brought up in these discussions or these sessions?
Yeah. So we get questions occasionally. I just want to make sure I understand the question. You're asking, do we train folks on how to use AI as leaders?
Exactly.
Yes. No. So one of the things that we talk about is, one, we're not AI experts, so we're not there to train you on that. And two is that we actually want to encourage people to really focus more on the human skills, right? I think as if you look back over the last 30, 40 years, as technology has accelerated, our leaders have moved farther and farther away from human skills. And we've moved more into technical skills. How do I write emails and do the technical work? And so what we're actually doing is not, it's not in opposition to AI, but it would be disingenuous at this point, I think, for us to say, but also we'll teach AI, right? The idea is we're leaning all the way back the other way. We're trying to pull the pendulum back to how do we teach you to be more empathetic, and how do we teach you to create a culture of accountability, or whatever you want to talk about. And I think trying to default to, well, how do I use AI to do that more, is basically counter to the message, which is like, no, no, don't, you know, I would tell people, don't do that. You know, you can put a few things if you want, maybe through Copilot or Gemini or whatever it is, to get a sense of what it is. But if you just copy and paste that, you are going to lose your people faster than you were even before, because the audience doesn't want an AI telling them how to be led. Yeah. So we actually push pretty hard against not to use AI, but don't use AI in place of what you need for human skills.
Right. Which is human skills.
Exactly. Yes.
And, you know, kind of looking forward now, how can you see, speaking of using AI, you know, tailored leaders, how can you guys see possibly using AI in the future? Is there anything that you guys want to implement from this workshop?
Yeah, I mean, coming out of the workshop, there were a couple of ideas that I wanted to do more broad searches on. He had talked about specific things and kind of getting a better understanding of how to, for simplest terms, maybe think of a potential customer base or whatever, a better, easier way to kind of consolidate information or to search across what public information is available. So that was interesting. I'd mentioned earlier the, if there were marketing, if we were ever to get more social media presence, how do we use AI, which I think can do a lot for us there as well. We're just not quite there yet, but it's something that we need to do, we know, at some point in the future. And then, yeah, we'll continue to use it for all the things we do. As far as, like I said, we don't use it to research, but it's a really good jumping off point that if we need to research something, or if we need to find something that is scientifically backed to explain, for example, resistance to change, right? You know, give me 20 examples of scientifically backed studies that kind of help explain humans' resistance to change. And then I can go in and I can start filtering through some of these things and seeing what information is available. So I think there's a lot of use for it. It'll be interesting to see how it moves in the future. But yeah, we will definitely be on the lookout to see what can be done as it goes. And we'll continue to use it. There's no world where if you're not using it, I think you're just falling behind.
That was HPR's Kevin Allen and Tailored Leadership Solutions, Evan Patek, talking about the use of AI as a small business. The Chamber of Commerce Hawaii will host another AI workshop for entrepreneurs on Tuesday, September 29th.
Support for HPR comes from KTA Superstores, serving the Hawaii Island community since 1916. Learn more about its support for the island community at ktasuperstores.com.
On the next Fresh Air, Paul Greengrass, the director who put us on board United 93 and made the Bourne movies. His new film, The Uprising, stars Andrew Garfield as a farmer who leads an army against the king. He'll tell us why he looked at a revolt from 1381 and saw us. Join us.
Support for HPR comes from the University of Hawaii Sea Grant College Program, engaging in research, education, and community engagement toward resilient and sustainable coastal and marine resources. HawaiiSeaGrant.org.
As Hawaii looks toward more potential storms over the next few days, Hurricane Lala is still at the top of people's minds. And today, our series, Homeroom Hawaii, takes a look at how it disrupted school schedules and home life. This week, we're hearing about trying to get work done without power, saving food in the cafeteria, getting campuses cleaned up after the hurricane, and the collective effect that natural disasters are having on many of our students and educators.
So crazy hurricane this past weekend, and that was wild.
It has been so stressful and heavy here in my community. This is Tiffany Edwards Hunt from Ke'a'au Middle School, mostly just contending with power outage and food preservation and bucket flushes with the toilet. We're all just feeling very blessed and feeling really sad for our Kau community that is just completely destroyed and having to rebuild and find loved ones and rebury them. And it's just very heavy, all of it.
Students really depend on school to be a space for routines and structures, things that they can expect. And so when our week got shifted to being 3 days instead of four last week, it's really hard for students to kind of come in after a long weekend, get into a groove, only have 3 days, and then shift. This is Kapua Chandler signing off from Namahana School.
This is Aura coming to you from Kanakakai Elementary School.
This is Tyler.
This is Judah.
This is King.
Hurricane Lala came on Monday, so that's when they canceled school. When I came back, I kept on getting confused on like what day it was.
There was a tree that fell on the roof of my garage, and now it has a big hole inside it. My mom and dad are probably gonna make me clean up.
There was a bunch of water everywhere inside like containers and like other things that hold water. So we all had to go outside and dump them all out so that the mosquitoes don't repopulate in them.
I got to hang out with my friends on Saturday, played some board games.
So the kids were kind of happy with the extra day of no school. And many of them wondered why we didn't come back to school on Monday. In our school, we're trying to practice empathy. And so I reminded them that throughout the state, many communities had been seriously impacted by Lala, and that we wanted to stand in solidarity with the other schools because we understood, especially after the Kona Law, how communities need some time to regroup. The kids understood that it's not just about us, it's about everyone that goes to school. Everyone is trying to take care of their own communities. It's hard sometimes to feel for other people when your life is sunshine and rainbows, yeah? This is Kumulo Kehan signing off. Ahuiho.
Aloha, this is Renee Gilsdorf coming to you from King Kamehameha III Elementary School. There just seems to be always rebuilding and always just a lot of heaviness in a way. We just had the Kona lows here, and that was really devastating as well, and the Lahaina fire, and it's just a lot.
I had to do a bunch of work online, but my power was actually out. So to do that, I went to one of my teacher's classes really early in the morning. I know him a lot. I messaged him about it, and I went to his class around like 6 to 6:30. And again, this is Audrin coming to you from Farrington High School. Out.
You know, just as being a counselor, like having to be able to encourage and uplift and still support everyone after those types of things happen, it's just really personal, and then personal comes into the workforce. And yeah, it's hard to draw boundaries when we're just human beings, and it's just so real for all of us to have to experience it.
This is Nikki Kiliona signing off from Waianae High School.
Aloha, this is Chet Collins coming to you from Kapa'a Middle School. We all experienced a storm last weekend. They canceled school on Monday, which, you know, is generally a nice thing, but it does create challenges for us. Mainly, what are we going to do with the food that we were planning to serve on Monday? When you're dealing with, you know, hamburger or chicken or pork, something that's been planned ahead for a menu, and then you have to switch things around, it can be kind of challenging.
We did have to come in, check the school, the property, the facilities, the grounds. We got it all cleaned up, as us custodians would. We pretty much just want to make sure that our children are safe. They're enjoying school. Every day is a challenge. But every day is a new thing, and every day comes positivity. And that's what I wake up every morning to do, is come to work and just be positive. And we all just go home with a bright, big smile on our faces. This is Nani Carvalho signing off from Kaloa Elementary School.
Besides the stress that comes with having a storm come through, there are some parent concerns that are going on that are escalating, almost becoming urgent. But in situations like that, that we all face, whatever we do in life, whether it's work or family, listening to concerns, building understanding, and having open communication with our families will help that situation. But more than that, this is the joy of the job that I get to do every day. Students have a way of just making you, like, they fill your heart with joy at the right moments. They say something funny. They let you know how they feel about you in some way. And it just makes the challenges of the week or what you're going through a little more bearable. This is Kaui Tanaka signing off from Mauna Wili Elementary School.
Unfortunately, we had another tragic death of a parent, which for our community is a lot in the last few weeks. And every tragedy death has a ripple effect. So it was a kind of another somber week for students. So far, they seem to be resilient and dealing with it well. We have our football team, which is actually an 8-man team, playing 11-man against McKinley. And then our volleyball team went off to Maui and they won their first game. So that was quite exciting, a great positive way to end a kind of crazy but short week. This is Katina Suarez, Principal Molokai High School, signing off.
How's it? This is Eha and I'm coming to you from Molokai High School. Something new that I've experienced from this school year is that I'm now a junior, which means I'm an upperclassman in both sports and in school, which means I'm somewhat of a role model or supposed to be an inspiration for younger classmen. And I really do hope that I can fulfill that role. And the sports I've been doing right now is football, which I have to do my first game pretty soon, which I'm very excited for, but I can't wait to do that.
Coming out on the other side of Hurricane Lala, seeing our community piece things back together, I kind of found myself sitting with a few heavy wonderings. One being, when did our children lose their joy and wonder? At what exact point does a young person lose hope for their future or start to believe that there's only one narrow path forward for them? And then when did we as a society forget that harmony isn't the absence of differences, but it's learning how to communicate through them and see past them? There may be a stigma that comes with being labeled as a struggling school, but a label will never, ever define our potential or dictate our future. Here at Barbers Point, I know we know who we are and we know what our kids deserve and are capable of. This is Mariko Yorimoto signing off from Barbers Point Elementary.
And that was this week's installment of Homeroom Hawaii. It's a new series where we spend time with voices from campuses across the state. It's the story of a school year told week by week. You can listen to past segments at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Homeroom Hawaii comes from Hawaii USA Federal Credit Union, helping Hawaii's next generation build financial confidence through student-run credit unions and youth monetary education. HawaiiUSAFCU.com.
Did you miss the latest edition of The Conversation or Fresh Air? Sometimes you just can't listen to your favorite show when it airs on HBR, but you can listen to it on demand with our free mobile app for your iPhone, iPad, or Android. It even integrates with Apple CarPlay and Android Auto, so you can listen hands-free in your car. Get the HBR app in the App Store or on Google Play.
And now it's time to reveal the answer to our backyard quiz. Earlier today, we asked you what island nation used the coconut to create full-body armor. Fun fact, this island nation paired their coconut armor with a resource from the sea, a pufferfish helmet. Warriors would fashion this helmet by agitating the pufferfish into expanding to its full size. From there, They would bury it under beach sand for several days so insects could eat away the internal organs. The sun would dry out the spiny skin into a helmet-shaped shell. The helmets were then reinforced with, you guessed it, coconut fibers. This armor was effective in minimizing bloodshed. Battles over limited island resources were common, and the heavy armor allowed champions to settle disputes with just a few bruises and scratches. And by heavy armor, we mean heavy. A warrior's full battle attire could weigh up to 30 pounds. And the name of the island nation we were looking for? Kiribati. And congrats to our winner, Arthur from Kailua Kona knew the answer because he teaches Pacific cultures. But that's our quiz for today. If you have one to share, write to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. Well, that does it for us today. Up tomorrow, emotions are running deep over the announced closure of a town's post office in Maui. The community pushes back. We do welcome feedback. Call or talk back line 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Find the conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.